It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
A mind-blowing conversation on the history of everything from interest rates to the Constitution. Plus, where will we be economically 1 year and 5 years from today? It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, at Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. You can catch the Will Cain Podcast as well on Rumble or on YouTube. I think today's conversation is fairly described as mind-blowing, at least it was for me. It's a conversation that stretches back through our history, looking at times 500 years of economics and interest rates, about what is special, unique about the United States of America, and a look forward. What's about to happen with the banking sector this summer? With interest rates, where will we be in 1 year? What does our economy look like over the next 5 years? Peter St. Orange is an economist at the Mises Institute. He's an associated scholar and an economic research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He got his PhD from George Mason University and was a 2014 Mises Institute research fellow. You can check out his content by subscribing to his newsletter, where he writes about Austrian economics and Bitcoin. He as well produces content at Heritage, Mises Institute, and a column at stonge.substack.com. That's stonge.substack.com. I think you will enjoy this conversation as it traverses the path from the economic history of the globe, to the Constitution of the United States, to the nuts and bolts of what is happening today in our economy with interest rates. What happens next with the Fed? Here's a fascinating conversation with Dr. Peter St. Onge. Peter St. Onge, so great to have you on the Will Cain Podcast.
So, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. We have you on during a week where banking and the economy is at the center of the news cycle, or it well should be. First Republic Bank has failed. It looks like it will be purchased by several other large conglomerates. And I think the question on everybody's mind is, as we look at the third bank failure in maybe a month's time, is, are we looking at something that is contagion and systemic? Are we looking at a nationwide banking crisis?
That is the big question on everybody's mind. And, you know, there have been various estimates of just how many losses are looking in the banking system. One study came out last month from Stanford that estimated that about thousands, multiple thousands of banks are in distress, because what is causing the problem here is something systemic. It's something that all banks across America did, which is that they invested in bonds and loans, where when interest rates come up too fast, those lose a ton of value, 20, 40% of value. So you have a ton of banks that have gigantic holes in their balance sheets. So at that point, the question becomes, can you bail them all out, right? Can other banks come in and rescue them, or, you know, like a convoy type, helping the weakest of the herd? And then alternatively, for those where, you know, other banks are unwilling to do that, is the government, is Janet Yellen or Jerome Powell going to come in and bail them all out? And that then raises fears, because what we've seen so far in these bank takeovers is that they end up in the hands of the gigantic mega banks that are increasingly dominating our economy. So are we going to get to a place where the entire financial system is too big to fail and there's nothing else out there?
So I want to try to understand everything that you have laid out, and I do this from time to time, but in my own words, if I can say it back to you in a way that I understand it, it means that maybe I truly do understand it. So my understanding, and it's what you laid out, I think, very eloquently, is we see probably a systemic-wide problem of bank management choosing to do something which I guess they had some historic reason to believe would be okay, and that is invest their money in long-term bonds. And that was, at the time, whatever it may have been, 2 or 3%. But the Fed comes in an attempt to tame inflation and raises interest rates to 4, 5, 6%. And if you're sitting there with a long-term asset that is drawing 2 or 3%, it is not worth very much anymore. And so the question is, why did so many bank managers choose to do that? Why did they never consider the prospect that, hey, interest rates could go up?
Yeah, part of it was that they got a gigantic influx of new money during the pandemic. So between stimulus checks, extremely generous benefits, a lot of people did not want to work, meaning that, you know, even for relatively middle class people, you had these sort of spikes in wages. So you had a ton of money flooding into the banking system and they had to deploy it. And, you know, it's sort of banking 101 that, you know, you stick it in government bonds. I mean, this is the standard default. It's normally thought of as extremely safe. The Fed at the time was saying inflation is transitory. It's just, you know, you got the boat stuck in the Suez. You know, you got supply chains are a little bit sticky, but that's all going to clear right up. And bankers, unfortunately, believed them. And so they did not imagine that we were going to see this. You know, I mean, really, the Fed has spiked rates so quickly. This is the fastest rate since the 1970s. 1970s was an epic era. You had like 17% mortgages. It was insane. None of these bankers had that on their bingo card.
That is crazy. They didn't have it on their bingo card, which shows that they just outsourced their judgment to the Fed. And it also suggests, as is always the case, the Fed has a ton of culpability in creating the environment to believe that interest rates would never go up. Now, tell me how this plays in. It seems like, I don't know, I guess a compounding factor that we certainly saw with Silicon Valley Bank, that on the consumer side of banking, people started realizing, hey, I don't need to leave my money sitting in a checking account that is getting nothing or a savings account that is getting very little. Look at treasuries now, short-term treasuries. I can invest them in a one-year treasury and I can get wherever they are, 4 or 5% now. And so people start pulling their money out of banks. So now banks have, and tell me if I'm understanding this correctly, not just a declining asset on their books in these treasuries, but now they have customers pulling the cash out from underneath them.
That is exactly right, Will. And people are pulling it out. They're putting it into money market accounts, which will give you 4.5%, 5%. You know, banks have been very stingy. They've been handing out pennies, pennies in interest. You know, I think a lot of Americans just don't even pay attention to bank interest. Like, I mean, they just forgot about it. It's like $1.87 a year. So people are pulling money out into these mutuals, money market funds. The money market funds, in turn, are parking a lot of that money at the Fed. This is one of the kind of sicker aspects of this here. So the Fed printed up all this money to smooth the way for lockdowns and, you know, to give money, to give government everything they needed. And the Fed knows that that's going to lead to inflation. So they had this separate program where they are paying people through, it's called the reverse repo program. But anyway, they pay banks and other like money market funds to park, turns out, trillions of dollars at the Fed, and then the Fed cuts them a check for interest. So the interest, of course, is yet more inflation. That's something like, what, it's around about $275 billion a year now that the Fed is actually paying more to banks to park the money that the Fed printed up than the banks make in profits. We have a functionally nationalized banking system at this point. And, you know, meanwhile, because it wasn't designed by choice, you know, it was all kind of ad hoc, you know, duct tape and bubblegum to kind of hold everything together. You've got all these little points in there where they're not quite connected and they're breaking. So in this particular case, right, you've got deposits flooding out of the system, going into the money markets. The money markets go over into the repo. Nobody at the Fed, you know, it didn't occur to anybody that something like this might happen. The Fed and the Treasury have been absolutely unprepared. It is seriously amateur hour here. And, you know, Jerome Powell just came out last year and he said, you know, he was questioned, why did you guys get the transitory inflation so wrong? And he said, well, we've learned a lot about how little we understand about inflation. And it's, Why are you guys still employed? Why is there still a Federal Reserve? Do you guys know anything about what you're supposed to be doing?
So on that note, Peter, do you think, and I want to talk about sort of what could unfold, I'm hesitant to call it over the long horizon or the long-term future, because we could be talking about over the next 12 months. But when it comes to what we've seen so far, when it comes to banking, is this really, you mentioned it, and the pandemic, is this pandemic era policies, is this flooding the system with money and people all of a sudden, the banking system being flush with cash, not offering anything for depositors in terms of a return, and then investing it in what they could find on the other side, 2-3% treasuries. Was this all a product, what we've seen so far? And I think we're going to get to, I want to talk to you about malinvestment in a minute, but what we've seen so far, is this all a product of things that politicians and the central banking system did in the pandemic? Print money, spend money.
Yep. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I love how you frame that, you know, because the other side always wants to say, oh, it was the pandemic. You know, what are you going to do? It was crazy times. No, all of this was the panicked reaction, the unhinged reaction, the pandemic. What they did was took all of the pendulums in the country and swung them way over as far as they could and just let them all go at once and see what happens. Absolutely reckless.
Okay, so then let's move to the long-term horizon because, you know, the Fed printing money, I mean, one could argue that we were already sort of redlining our ability to absorb the amount of cash we were shoving into the system before the pandemic. And then we get to the pandemic, and I don't know if there's something beyond fifth gear. We hit turbo booster in the car. we hit the jets. But we were already in fifth gear. We were already redlining the RPMs, meaning low interest rates for two decades, shoving money into the system. And many argue, and I think correctly, what that does over time is it allows for bad investment, fraud even. You know, people can get away with anything, bad decisions. So the question now becomes, have we reached that moment in our economy of finally the bell has tolled that all this malinvestment, all these bad decisions, all this fraud is going to be exposed? And I said over the next 12 months, you know, what are we going to see? And everybody's talking about a recession. I'm more worried than whatever that means, a recession. And I think that people suggest to me the first place that you're going to start seeing it is in banking, and it's going to revolve around commercial real estate.
Yeah, absolutely. Commercial real estate is, I think, the biggest canary in the coal mine right now. It's an $11 trillion industry. We are getting anecdotal reports from developers. There was one major one. Brand name developer, been in the gig for a long time. He said their bank pulled funding out of all of a sudden for a 25-story building. This is a major project. He called around 100 banks. Nobody would lend. All right. So there's absolute freezes going on across the country in commercial real estate. Meanwhile, of course, the cities are emptying out. You know, a lot of people can work from home. A lot of cities in the country are, it's not safe, it's dirty. People are moving out of the city, so there's all of this stranded real estate. I think San Francisco is close to 27% empty office space right now. That is a huge concern. You know, you put all of these together, and I think we're going to be looking at just crisis after crisis after crisis. And, you know, each one, they're going to say, it's a perfect storm. You know, everything just and at some point, you say, well, maybe this system has a fundamental problem. Maybe our financial system is not actually sound. Maybe you guys have, you know, designed it with too many failure points in there. And so, yeah, everything looks like a perfect storm. At which point, you know, I think we are going to see a lot of bankruptcies, a lot of malinvestment liquidated. The habit that our federal government has gotten into over certainly the past 50 years is that every time there is some sort of storm, they panic, they, you know, pour out more trillions of dollars, they pull rates down back to zero. That is cumulatively giving us a zombie economy. We're starting to look like Japan now, where it's not just too big to fail, it's, you know, I mean, every single company, you know, is going to get a big fat check so that nobody is going to fail at all. That is a recipe for absolute stagnation in the economy. If you are getting that while the inflation is still galloping, that puts us back in the 1970s, the stagflation era that many of us hoped would never come back.
So to draw that out for me, would you, over maybe a 12-month period and then over a five-year period? I hear you say rolling crises. First of all, with this, let me kind of lay out the questions I'd love you to answer when you give us this prediction. Will the Fed continue to raise interest rates? A. B. Will that cause what kind of recession? C, what does that mean for these, as you describe it, rolling crises, maybe over a year period? And then D, are you saying over a five-year period, we evolve into the zombie economy that looks like Japan that is driven by stagflation? But I would ask you to factor in the counter that many people say, we're still the reserve currency, we're still the world's number one economy, and that gives us, I guess, access to the liquor cabinet as long as we want.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so the Fed is already signaling that it's in for one more cut, just, you know, kind of prove that this is its turf, I guess, at which point it and markets in general expect a plateau for a couple months. And then actually markets expected to start cutting, which means either they're on the verge of victory or they're on the verge of dismal failure, at which point they panic cut. In terms of the 5-year, I think we are almost guaranteed, you know, we have already lost about half of the sort of structural growth that we had in the 20th century. All right, so if you take the period going up to the year 2000 and the period since, which has been this exceptionally low interest rate period, low interest rates are a recipe for stagnation. You get a lot of activity. Everybody looks really busy because money is easy and everybody can get, you know, free financing for pets.com or whatever. You look very busy, but you don't actually build sustainable businesses that last. So that era of easy money, yes, it gets the politicians out of the headlines. It covers a lot of bureaucratic butts, but it means that we are sapping. I mean, we are in the process of turning this into a zombie economy. You know, we've got fundamental productivity growth at about half the rate already. Now the question is, are we going to kill the other half of it? If we get into a situation where inflation is still rampant and the economy is starting to turn, then I think they are going to double down on what they did in 2008, in 2001. They are going to try to bail out anything in sight. I think that moves us a long ways towards the zombie. Now, in terms of the question that, you know, the U.S. is not Japan because we have the dollar and because we're the number one economy. Well, I mean, we have three times more people than Japan. So yes, we have a larger GDP, but in terms of economic growth, we haven't been number one for a long, long time, certainly since Richard Nixon. We have had slow growth going on, you know, decades now. We've got generations. You know, a couple generations ago, every parent in America knew that their kid was going to be better off than them, not just a little bit, but like double. Okay, and that is no longer the case. You've got millennials, you've got Gen Zs now who they have no idea what to do. They can't get a decent job. You know, it's all basically manual labor. They can't even dream of getting a house. We are absolutely not the number one economy that people might have in their heads, that 1950s, 1960s, you know, sort of world striding economy. And, you know, at this point, the reserve currency, I think, is almost more of a risk than it is an asset. Because the Biden administration has been doing everything they can to chase foreigners out of the dollar. If that continues, that could actually lead to another round of bank crashes and potentially double-digit inflation here in the U.S.
What do you mean the Biden administration is doing everything they can to chase foreigners out of the dollar?
There's two things fundamentally that drive foreigners to adopt the dollar. And, you know, sort of the big picture here is that over the years, we have printed roughly three times more dollars than the American people need for here at home. Okay. And that extra 2x of dollars is running around overseas. Part of it is used for trade. Almost every, you know, international industry trades in U.S. dollars. And then another big chunk of it is simply held by foreigners. So, like, if you're a rich Mexican, if you've got millions of dollars, you are not holding those in pesos. You've been burned before. You know how that ends. Okay. You're holding a tiny bit in pesos for your day-to-day use, and the rest of it is in U.S. dollars. And this is true all over the world. It's true in China and India and Africa, everywhere. So why do those people hold those dollars? A, because historically the U.S. has had pretty good inflation, so they could be confident that those dollars are not going to melt away. And B, they have been confident that, you know, the U.S. is rule of law. They're not going to come in and take away your dollars. They're not going to seize them. And that's been especially important for nations holding assets, right? So, you know, really countries all over the world, China, of course, but, you know, everything from Brazil to South Africa, they park most of their national assets, their overseas assets, they park those in dollars because they're relatively safe. Because they're relatively safe, there's a lot of them floating around. because there's a lot of them floating around, they are liquid, right? It's very cheap to buy and sell them. What Biden did last year is threw a wrench in that finely tuned machine by going after Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. What they did specifically was that they seized Russia's sovereign dollars. So those were the dollars held by the Russian central bank. Now, Russia is bad. Putin is bad. But even during the Cold War, we did not do that. All right. We had hot wars. We had hot proxy wars going on every continent. And we never even contemplated doing that because it is dumb. If you do that, if you chase your enemy off, not only have you lost leverage with them, every other country in the world was watching that. And they are now talking about that. The president of Indonesia, he said, literally, we got to get off the dollar because look at what happened to Russia. Now, Indonesia is not planning on invading Ukraine for sure. But the issue here is that the U.S. government, because it is so activist driven, right, whether it's, you know, ESG and environmental, whether it's LGBT, whatever the issues are, a country like Indonesia or Saudi Arabia, they have no idea when the activists are going to turn on them. And when they do, are they going to get the Russia treatment, which means pulling the rug on what Russia thought was their sovereign assets? You know, the amount we pulled in Russia was about $300 billion. But given the size of the Russian economy, that was about $4 trillion to them. That was the entire basis of their financial system. We did it to crash them. But the point is that Brazil, Indonesia, all these other countries looking at that. Now, China is no dummy. China walks in and they say, well, guys, you know, look at what happened. We would never do this to you. And so these countries are diversifying away. China has a giant fat checkbook that they use to try to bring countries into their BRICS system. You know, they give them development loans and all this. And it was actually Larry Summers who summed it up really nicely. He said, you know, when it comes to international relations, China walks in with a checkbook. The U.S. walks in with a lecture. That is what the Biden administration is doing. They are almost, it almost looks like they're intentionally chasing countries out of the dollar. What happens though, dollars come flooding back into this economy, which means inflation.
Wow, what an amazing answer that blows my mind. So the reason we're the world's reserve currency is because A, we have had a historically good record of controlling inflation, giving sovereign powers and sovereign individuals trust that our money is sound and it won't be, as you described it, melted away. B, we have the rule of law. And I think most people could understand that over the last, I think through the Biden administration, as we've looked at the various departments of the federal government pursue their own either activist or political agendas, you can't quite have the same level of trust in the rule of law, at least evenly applied, as you might have had 10, 20 years ago. And then finally, see the activist vision of the American government. That is absolutely fascinating. In particular, that one moment. Now, I don't know. I guess if I wanted to be really, really, you know, I don't want to have a debate. I just want to find myself on solid footing. If I had somebody here who disagreed with you, they would say, there's a far, look, Peter, there's a far leap from the United States seizing Russia's funds versus, you know, Saudi Arabia's because we don't like their policy on LGBTQ or feminism issues. That's a huge leap that you're making. But what you're telling me is, well, it was a huge leap for us to take anyone's funds historically with Russia. And I'm not projecting me, Peter St. Ange. I'm not projecting. Indonesia's already telling you the world is scared about the United States and the trust we've invested in their willingness, not ability, their willingness to protect our investment.
Yep, that is exactly right. It was completely unimaginable that we would do something so stupid because we had never done that for countries we were at war with. We did not do that. Why? Because we were looking to the greater good that you want the entire world to be reliant on the U.S. dollar. They threw that away.
Fascinating. And then you say what they do is they sell the dollar, they sell their investments, the 2x world floating dollar out there comes flooding back onto our shores, compounding the spin of inflation here at home. Just absolutely mind blowing. I want to pursue the political path with you. But before I do, let me put a ribbon on two economic questions. I have a friend of mine who's in finance, and he said to me, he's very hawkish. He's very conservative. He's very value investment oriented. And he said, look, man, the history of interest rates is 4, 5, 6%. It is higher than what we have lived with in our lifetime. So this idea that the economy that everyone listening has either grown up in or at least forgotten about, the one that existed previously, is the aberration. The actual historical norm is high interest rates, harder to get money.
Mm-hmm. Your friend is absolutely correct. You know, there's solid data on this going back 800 years that the Bank of England has compiled. And traditional interest rates, first of all, traditionally over that period, you had zero inflation. Inflation is a central bank invention. That is something completely, I mean, you had periods during wars and whatnot, but over, you know, century long periods, you had no inflation. And interest rates were about 3.5%, 4%, 4.5%. That is what's natural. The problem where we are right now is that if you yank interest rates down to nearly 0% and you let that run for a couple of years, you're going to do exactly what you were talking about earlier. You're going to get malinvestments. You get all these crap companies that never should have been started. The only reason they were started is because money was so cheap. Mm-hmm. Those are going to, right? They're all going to get started. And then if you raise rates to, you know, the proper level of 4.5%, 5%, a whole bunch of those are going to go bust all at once, which we have a word for that. It's a recession, right? You're going to get mass joblessness, this and that. That is what we would want to avoid. So where we are right now, I think, is that we actually probably have to lower rates a little bit because we have to ease people into what the rates should be. It was too much of a shock going from 0 to 5 all at once. I don't know, 2, 2.5. Kind of let people ease out, let some of the crappier businesses go first, kind of ease it up little by little. Instead, they yanked it up against, I mean, really all schools and economics know what you're going to get if you ramp rates up that fast. And then what we would hope to get to in the long run is exactly what you're talking about. Something like 4 or 5% rates all the time. Don't budge them.
Right.
Let the market determine what they're going to be.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Let me continue to ask you about the economy then. So we have lived through this aberration, this historical anomaly. And now I'm giving you some of my opinion, adding it on to this idea that interest rates have never been this way throughout history. You talked about the U.S.'s economic growth through, really, it was more than a half a century, let's call it 70 years of the U.S. economy's history. I would argue that's also an aberration. Peter, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. I think even politically, we lived through an aberration through the mid-20th century. This idea of bipartisanship and everybody's, you know, bandwidth of disagreement was very narrow, and we all kind of agreed on the way we viewed the world. And that was emboldened by the U.S. economy, which was growing this middle class. And everybody had the idea, like you said, that the next generation is going to get better. The next decade's going to get better. We're all going to be on this path towards progress. Now, again, I think historically, that's not the story of humankind or the economy.
For sure.
And that doesn't mean that's good or bad. That's just what it is. We, you know, like historically, we have been a stagnant human species. I mean, the story of our history is you want to talk about a hockey stick, we spiked with the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly.
Now we're kind of moving into this post-Industrial Revolution economy. And it's either that we turn to the historical norms, which is no middle class, it's elites and the poor, and we return to that, or we evolve into the next revolution, which I don't know, what is that? The technological revolution, the AI revolution? Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but it says to me that our future isn't one where we can get back to the 1960s economically. Our future is one that we hope is some either unexplored vision, or it's going to look a lot like the 1700s.
Yeah, I think it's you're absolutely right that almost the entirety of human history has been stagnation. There have been little golden ages. They sprout out. They get about 100, 150 good years at best, and then they collapse again over and over. And I mean, really, you know, if you look at the grand scheme of human history, you can take it all the way up to pretty much the Industrial Revolution, and it's fairly flat. It's kind of embarrassing. And, you know, that's important for people to remember, you know, if they get complacent that, you know, things have been growing forever. My great grandfather, things are always going to be grand. No, the state of nature is to regress back to survival level. It is extremely important to conserve the institutions that have gotten us here that can keep us here. And I do think it's possible to get back to that nirvana. It's probably the 1880s, 1890s is, I mean, honestly, it's the peak period in human history. We call it the Gilded Age here because socialist journalists got to rename it, but really it's the Golden Age. I think that there is a very good chance of getting back to that economically. It would take a reversal of the FDR revolution is really what killed it. It was the famous switch in nine that saved nine when FDR threatened to pack the Supreme Court. It was effectively a coup against the court, a coup against the Constitution. It would take reversing that. I think that's so outside the political Overton for most Americans that, unfortunately, you know, the only two ways to get there are either to see a genuine crisis where people actually look for creative solutions, or just as you and I are doing right here, to explain it to people exactly what it's going to take so they get angry enough to do it before they have to.
The only economy that I think almost everyone understands, and this is partially because the information age also came about at the same time we transitioned the economy, the only one we really truly understand is the post-FDR economy. It's, you know, the suburbs and everybody now has a car. So, and that's, and by the way, in everyone's mind, maybe because that's how people wrote history, that was the golden era, right? That was everyone got a college degree, everyone got the job. But you're telling me that's actually when it began to be ruined or slowed down, that the golden age was the 1880s and 1890s, which the history that we're taught, Peter, is that was boom and bust America. That was get rich and then go broke. So tell me your vision of it. Explain, even me, who I consider myself decently historically curious. You know, I think of the 1880s, of course, I'm from Texas, so I'm thinking of, you know, oil booms and cowboys and ranchers. But explain to me what was so golden about the 1880s and 1890s economy.
Yeah, really, it goes from about the 1880s up until right before World War One. World War One was really what kind of killed it. They had a mass. It was effectively a nationalization of the entire economy. We had almost a Soviet economy during World War One. But anyway, so taking the period from about 1880 to, you know, call it 1912. Almost everything that we have in the modern age was invented. All right, every single thing that Elon Musk does for a living came out of that period. We think it's all modern. Subways, pneumatic tubes, electric engines, magnetism, airplanes, computers. Every single thing that matters was invented in that 35-year period. If we had kept going, we'd probably be immortal. Hang on. It's sad to think what we've thrown away. Anyway, that was the golden age. After that, we were basically running on fumes. We were killing off the golden geese one by one. Yes, we still had some. You know, we had people who had been raised in that golden age who were still very entrepreneurial. We still had a decent schooling system back then. You know, parents tended to have control over it. It wasn't institutionalized and bureaucratized. So it took two generations to run down the human capital that we had built up during that era. And so during those periods, of course, you know, we made more progress than going backwards. Now, of course, you know, there are places that have gone backwards. You know, there are a lot of places in the U.S. where if you look at the quality of life today and you compare it, that's the whole reason we're talking about this. It has gone backwards in many ways.
Well, so, but still, I want you to explain to me why. Why did that happen from 1880 to 1912? Why did we have all these geniuses making these life-altering inventions? Again, I think this is just sort of my, you know, painting in abstract pictures. I would have guessed that's because, well, we're at the beginning or the early stages of the Industrial Revolution and you know, the implication or the understanding of what fossil fuels have added to the economy. And now we've created this world where people can afford to think creatively. I don't know. Explain to me why that happened in that 30-year period.
Yeah, so very specifically, there was a legal doctrine at the time that was known as substantive due process. And it's also called the Lochner era. Okay. And the sort of philosophy in that era was that economic rights are human rights co-equal to all of your other rights. So equal to your right to free speech and religion and so on, you had a right to work at any wage, to create any product that did not harm other people, right? There was a much deeper understanding of economic rights. And so that meant that effectively, if you had a good idea, you did it. and nobody told you no. If you hurt somebody, if your product was poison, then you would get sued. You would have to, you know, pay enormous amounts. You would be ruined if you killed somebody with your product. So there were, you know, there was a built-in incentive not to do that. But you did not have the regulatory state yet. You had an economy that was where risk was policed via the tort system, right? Tort is the age-old way of handling risk. It basically says if you company do something bad, you have to pay for it. Now, contrast with what we have today, which is that industries not only, you know, they have regulators, they make friends with the regulators, they give donations to politicians. You know, we've seen another number of industries, including pharmaceutical, that is not even subject to tort anymore. It can really, it can do anything it wants as long as it negotiates immunity. I would argue that we have a much worse system in terms of imposing responsibility on companies. But what we certainly have, by all accounts, is that we have a gatekeeper economy where if you have a great idea, there are some industries where you can still do it. Content, the industry we're in, we are protected because the First Amendment is treated more seriously. But, you know, if you've got a new product, it dramatically increases the cost to bring it to market. You know, if you want to start a bank tomorrow, good luck. It's going to take a whole ton of money. In the late 19th century, you could build whatever you want. Let me give you an example. Yankees games. So they would play them, and because of how the stadium was built, some of the houses could see them, right? So what people would do is reinforce their porch roofs and put some stairs in there. Or, you know, maybe rig the window so you can climb out through the window. And they would put seats up there. And then mom would be cooking downstairs. And nobody came after them. You know, there were no cops in there. There were no FDA. There was no OSHA. There was no rest of that. That doesn't exist anymore. Why? Because we have this gigantic regulatory state. If you even try doing something like that, no way. So multiply that across the entire economy. When we go back, all it would take is a Supreme Court that would dust off the Lochner era doctrines. But if we went back to that, we would have an absolute explosion in entrepreneurship. Most Americans are fundamentally entrepreneurs. They're just they're in chains at the moment.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Oh, fascinating. What a fascinating understanding of history. Okay, a couple other things before we go today. What is your outlook, Peter, as we enter this technological era, and I think there's not, in my estimation, and we talk about it here on the Will Cain podcast, like we should be talking about the role of artificial intelligence all the time. It's going to fundamentally change so much. But as we talk about technology and as we evolve as an economy, a lot of people bring it into the realm of the currency as well. So, and I think the government is interested in it as well, the digital currency. I guess, is this an inevitability? And if it is an inevitability, what Pandora's box does that open? People talk about the social credit system and things like that, but I just wonder if this box can be, it may already be open, and can we avoid opening Pandora's box?
I think we absolutely can. I do not think a CBDC or a digital dollar or a surveillance coin is inevitable at all. We have a Fourth Amendment in this country. It is currently in exile. It is not being used. You know, in a sense, we already have an almost East German style police state operating, certainly in the financial system, called the Banking Secrecy Act. In many ways, that, you know, ship has sailed. It shouldn't have sailed, not according to the Fourth Amendment, which protects you, your privacy rights, right? The government can't just come snooping in because they're curious. They actually have to have probable cause and such. So if the courts are actually going to take the Fourth seriously, then, you know, I think, first of all, something like a CBDC would be, on the face of it, unconstitutional. The way that a CBDC, a so-called digital dollar, the way that it's designed, necessarily, by architecture, the government is going to know exactly what you do. Over these past couple of years, we've seen that, you know, even when there's a formal restriction against it, government shares information. They help each other out. They're all on the same team. They will share information with whomever they like. You will have an absolute surveillance state. It is only too tempting to then control people. But I'm very, very confident. You know, I think in the Fourth Amendment, I think the single superpower that we have as Americans is the Constitution. And currently, you know, you have the Constitution in exile. It's not entirely being paid attention to. But, honestly, I think that the solution to all of our problems is in the Constitution. And in this case, the Fourth Amendment, you cannot have a surveillance coin.
Oh, we're going to end with the Constitution in just one moment. So, and then I think we have to tie together the conversation. If we have a currency which is capable of complete surveillance, it's also unprotected from the activist class of the United States government. Foreign powers are looking at us and saying, you're beholden to so much of this activist class, and you're going to seize our dollars because we don't comply with your vision of what, social justice may be, that's going to apply to Americans as well, right? So our banking system, meaning our access to loans, our credit scores, whatever it may be. Hey, Will, you're not good on the climate. We don't like your views on whatever is the currently in vogue fashion of the moment 10 minutes ago movement. And so, you know, your dollar's not quite worth as much as Peter's.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that surveillance nature could go two ways, right? One of them could be that you would have a dollar where the U.S. government gets to see what all the foreigners are doing with their dollars. They're not going to be too thrilled about that, right? You know, if people are trading dollars among themselves, or, you know, saving in like Egypt, you know, if this is all known to the U.S. government, that might be uncomfortable for them. Alternatively, you know, if we look at other areas, governments are very, very eager to share information with each other, generally because what they horse trade is trying to crack down on tax evasion, right? So the U.S. government shares information all the time with even China in order because there's money in it for them, right? They don't care about our privacy. They care about collecting more taxes. If we have a digital dollar, I think there is a very good chance that the U.S. government would share that information with all kinds of countries in the world. And depending on what you do, for instance, if you're a journalist who travels to different countries, that may cause a problem.
Oh, wow. Okay. I love, and I share your love of the Constitution. I love your reverence for the Constitution. I agree as well. It is our superpower, you know, and I don't think it's any coincidence. I don't think it's a mistake of colloquialism, of conversation, that so many today elevate. We're a democracy. It's a threat to democracy. We're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic whose minority interests are protected by the United States Constitution. You talking about it being the superpower makes me wonder, and I've wondered this. You know, look, South Africa, when did they redo their constitution? I can't remember. It may have been in the 70s or 80s, maybe it's the 90s. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg famously said, it's a better constitution than the United States of America. It's full of all these positive rights, right? Positive rights, and we can do that conversation another time, but positive rights are the story of most governments and most countries' constitution. The USSR's constitution, chock full of positive rights, which were all BS, by the way. You didn't get them. You just got the promise of these positive rights. But in the United States, ours was based on the concept of negative rights, what we're free from. I'm curious in your thought, and I bring up the Soviets and I bring up South Africa because, and the French for that matter, people have tried at various times in human history to develop other forms of a constitution, and they failed. Ours was uniquely special. And I'm curious why you think that is. Do you think the founding fathers were just like, because the left is always going to go, these guys weren't geniuses. They weren't smarter than the best of our thinkers today. What made them so special? They're not gods. And all that's true. But they did come up with something that is amazing, and no one else has been able to truly replicate. And I wonder why.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. In short, I think that they were. I think that they were far, far smarter, possibly than any other cohort in the history of the world. And that might sound goofy, but honestly, you know, this was an era where the big philosophical questions were being addressed in Europe. England had, you know, just gotten rich. And so a lot of the sort of intellectual progress was being made in England. And because there were so many opportunities in the New World, the Englishmen who went to America were the cream of the cream. You know, we talked today about the immigrant bonus, right? That, you know, immigrants tend to work harder and all of this. Well, yes, that was true back then as well. So we sort of skimmed the cream off of the cream of the world at that time. right, England, and we concentrated them all in this place where there was just unlimited potential. I mean, it's really an amazing, almost Robert Heinlein like creation story here, where, you know, like you had the perfect environment to just take all of these geniuses and then see what kind of world they would develop. And it turns out that, you know, they created really, I think, almost an anomaly in human history. They created a constitution, meaning something that binds democracy, to be frank. It binds democracy. It binds the elite, right? They created that sort of standard constitutional boundaries, but they did it in a way that absolutely prioritized freedom, right? So-called negative rights, right? Positive rights are a question of slavery. Somebody enslaves somebody else. If I have a right to a house, then you must build that house for me, right? That is not freedom. No, our constitution alone. And I mean, through the entire thing, it is astounding. There were a couple elements in there that had to be fixed because they had to bring Southerners on board. Accepting that completely, the people who wrote it were disgusted at having to make those. The core of the document is always putting freedom above all with no compromises.
It's amazing. It's amazing. And the truth is, the places where the U.S. Constitution failed, as you alluded to, with slavery, are places where it didn't live up to its own ideals. Not that it failed to enshrine some forgotten
exactly.
ideal. What a fascinating conversation. I hope it's not our last. Peter St. Ange, thank you so much.
Definitely. Thank you, Will. It's been a pleasure.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Peter St. Ange. You can follow him on Twitter at Prof. St. Ange. That's Profstonge. If you enjoyed this conversation, I hope you will leave it a 5-star review, and I will see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.